Hello again, everyone, and welcome to another edition of KHOI Community Radio's Capital Week. You're listening Post for Politics, Iowa Style, where we explore and analyze who's been making news in and around the state capital, what that news is, and what it all means. We are glad you're with us. I'm Dennis Hart, joined as always by my partner in politics, Laura Bellin, of the blog site Leading Heartland. Welcome, Laura.
Good to be here, Dennis.
The midterm election came and went a couple of weeks ago, but we are still dealing with some vote counts and the fallout from that election. Plus, National Democrats are edging closer to deciding the fate of Iowa's first in the nation Democratic caucuses. That's all part of what we're going to hash out on this evening's special one-hour program of Capital Week. But first, the man who once again injected himself into the forefront of American political discourse last week, who else but Donald Trump? He officially announced he's going to run again in 2024 after losing to President Biden in 2020. Laura, so much to talk about involving former President Trump. So let's just start with, here we go again.
Yes, and it was not a surprise to anyone, but it'll be, I'm so interested to see how this plays out in the Republican presidential field in Iowa.
Absolutely. The former president spoke for more than 1 hour last Tuesday night, saying the U.S. is in what he called grave trouble. He painted a bleak picture of the Biden administration vowing to reverse almost everything his successor has done. He said a lot of things in that 1 hour. So, and now it's reverberating all across the United States, all across the Republican Party. And perhaps the first question involving us here tonight, what does his announcement, Laura, in your assessment, mean for the Republican Iowa caucuses in early 2024? We should say the GOP is planning to keep its first in the nation caucuses here. What does it mean for those caucuses?
Yes, there's no chance that the Republicans will change their calendar. Iowa is definitely going to be first. I confess that I didn't watch the entire hour. I did watch a good chunk of Donald Trump's announcement speech. I think it was what he might call low energy. It wasn't, compared to some other rally speeches that I've seen from him, he didn't seem to be really fired up about it. I don't think he's going to clear the field here. I think maybe a year ago, I might have said that nobody else would have any chance at all of getting traction against Donald Trump. But I think it's possible. I think that Iowa Republicans, there may be enough of them who have an open mind about who should be president again. He's still very well liked, though, in Iowa GOP circles.
Absolutely. A July Des Moines Register poll showed 57% of state Republicans hoped he would run again, though 57% of all Iowans hoped he would not. And an October Des Moines Register poll found that 83%, more than 8 out of 10 Republicans, have favorable views of Trump. It's down a bit from 91% last fall, but he clearly remains perhaps the favorite for the caucuses in this early stage.
Definitely. You have to consider him the strong front runner, even though he did not win the caucuses in 2016. He was leading in most of the polls ahead of the caucuses, but Ted Cruz ended up edging him out. So the evangelical Christian bloc tends to be very strong in the Iowa caucuses. They delivered surprise victory for Mike Huckabee in 2008 and again for Ted Cruz. So I think it's possible that someone else could make a run at it. But right now, you would probably not want to bet against Trump.
Of course, Trump had shown up at the Sioux City Airport before the election to fully endorse Chuck Grassley running for the U.S. Senate against Mike Franken and Kim Reynolds. But the interesting thing is that not all Republicans jumped right on the Trump bandwagon after he announced. For example, Senator Grassley did not endorse Trump after his announcement.
Well, this is going to be very interesting to see how this plays out, because Donald Trump, one thing that it seems to be a little bit of a trigger for him is when he feels that Republican politicians are not grateful enough for support that he has given them in the past. And I was waiting and watching to see whether he would lash out on social media against any of the Iowa Republicans whose careers he supported, who didn't come out and endorse him right away. But I must say that Chuck Grassley, traditionally, in all of these years, he usually doesn't endorse anyone ahead of the Republican caucuses. And Terry Branstad also usually doesn't endorse anyone before the caucuses. So Ashley Hinson, my recollection is that she did not endorse anyone. She was brand new in the state legislature before the 2016 caucuses. So my recollection was that she also didn't endorse. Now, Terry Brand said he did come out shortly before the 2016 caucuses and say that if Ted Cruz won, that would be bad for ethanol. So it was perceived as kind of a backhanded Trump endorsement, but it wasn't exactly a Trump endorsement. And so I'm waiting to see whether how patient Donald Trump is going to be with all of these Republicans not coming out and joining the bandwagon.
Right. And Bob Vanderplas, the pretty well-known president of the Christian conservative group, the family leader in Iowa, he became more outspoken against a possible renewed Trump candidacy. Did that surprise you?
No. Vanderplas has never been a big Trump supporter. He was a Ted Cruz endorser. He is the family leader, for those who aren't familiar. This is one of the leading social conservative organizations in Iowa. He was a big advocate for Mike Huckabee back before those 2008 caucuses. And he was late. I went back and looked in the summer of 2016, even after it was clear that Donald Trump was going to be the presidential nominee. It was quite a while, several weeks before Bob Vanderplas officially gave his endorsement to Trump. So I think he's always had a lot of reservations about him, even though generally Trump has had strong support among white evangelical Christians. Bob Vanderplas in particular has been a little bit of a skeptic. So I think this is going to be somewhat of a test of his clout to see how many Republican caucus goers or rank and file Iowa Republicans are willing to give other candidates a fair hearing before the next caucuses.
One of the most interesting things that we're going to be watching over the next couple of years, which I guess renews us on Capitol Week for at least two more years, is that whether any Republicans are going to, number one, run against the former president nationwide, but let's bring it down first here to the caucuses in 2024, is going to enter the cycle, as you have said, as the front runner. He has already started attacking Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, a giant winner on election night down in Florida, calling him disloyal and coining the name Rhonda Sanctimonious.
Right. I heard somebody posted a graphic that Google searches for the word sanctimonious just skyrocketed after that comment.
He also took aim at Virginia Governor Glenn Youngkin, another possible contender in 2024. I'm laughing only because it seems so ridiculous. Mocking the governor's name as it sounds Chinese.
I will say I do not expect Glenn Youngkin to run for president. I know he hasn't officially ruled it out, but I think that he is, I just see him possibly going in a different direction. But who knows? It's going to be a crowded field. There are a lot of people, as we've talked about, Mike Pence, Pompeo, the former Secretary of State. I think that Nikki Haley is probably going to get in. So definitely, if I'm Ron DeSantis, I would definitely test the waters in Iowa. I don't see why he wouldn't necessarily find a receptive audience. I think the advantage that Trump may have is that if it's a very crowded field, that was the advantage he had in 2015 and early 2016. There were just too many people splitting the votes of Republicans who were skeptics about Trump.
And that probably is what the former president hopes happens. If you bring in a Pence, a Pompeo, Nikki Haley, Tim Scott of South Carolina, the governor of Arkansas, Asa Hutchinson, even the conservative talk show host Larry Elder, who's famous out here in California, six or seven people running against him, and it splits the vote, the anti-Trump vote, and Trump skates in just like he did in 2016.
And it's tricky, going back to what we were just talking about some of these politicians not endorsing. If you're Chuck Grassley or Ashley Hinson or Kim Reynolds, you want to have a lot of politicians going around the state doing events. These are very beneficial for county level or local Republican Party organizations to be able to have somebody at the breakfast or the spaghetti supper. And so it's good for Iowa Republicans to have lots of candidates pounding the pavement here. Now, whether that produces the most electable nominee is another question, but I don't think that anybody, even if some of these politicians endorse shortly before the caucuses, they certainly aren't going to want to discourage anyone from coming in campaigning. So I don't think we're going to see any really high-profile endorsements early.
All right. So there's already started to be some speculation about who Trump might choose for a vice president if he wins the nomination. I can pretty much guarantee, and so can you, it will not be Mike Pence, because, of course, Pence has just come out with a book. And he's been on ABC's World News Tonight and other television newscasts, in which he pretty much indicates his dislike of what the president put him through on that day on January 6th. So it's not going to be Mike Pence, but could it be? And I've heard this, I've seen this out there, I believe in the Wall Street Journal. Is Kim Reynolds a possibility for VP?
I hear that speculation. I will say that I believe that Kim Reynolds wants to remain governor for a long time, but certainly there are a lot of Iowans who think that she may have ambitions to be on the ticket. Joni Ernst reportedly was invited to be considered as on Trump's shortlist for VP in 2016. So I wouldn't necessarily rule that out. Joni Ernst is not up for re-election in 2024, so she could be on a national ticket without compromising the Senate seat if it weren't successful. Carrie Lake losing in the Arizona governor's race is a leg up for Kim Reynolds if you believe that she has ambitions to be on Donald Trump's ticket. But Kristi Noem of South Dakota is also somebody who's there's been speculation about. And I think that Trump might do well to pick a woman because Republicans have had an increasing problem with a gender gap in elections in a lot of states here.
Well, crazy time is about to start. That means caucus time in Iowa. Crazy is a good thing if you love politics, as you and I do. But the Republicans will definitely hold their first in the nation caucuses there. But the Democrats, after being slaughtered in Iowa in the election 2 weeks ago, and they were in trouble even before that, the DNC is going to meet in early December to decide whether the Dems get to hold their official first in the nation caucuses again. What do you think?
Well, I think that they will replace Iowa on the nominating calendar. I've been talking with people about this. I mean, the one argument that you can make is that if Joe Biden is going to run for second term, which most people believe he will, then the Iowa caucuses are probably not going to be competitive. And some people think the DNC is just going to kick the can down the road, keep the calendar the way it is for 2024. Then in 2028, one way or another, it's going to be an open field, and that's when they would replace Iowa. But I think that even for the 2024 cycle, they will want to have a trial run. Even if Joe Biden doesn't face serious competition, they will want some other state to go first with a primary. I personally think that Michigan is a leading candidate or some other swing state. I think that the Democrats are going to want to have their presidential field out there talking to voters in a swing state. And right now, Iowa doesn't look very much like a swing state anymore.
Even if the national Dems pull their support from Iowa, Iowa could still hold the Democrats their own caucus, couldn't they?
Well, in fact, they may have to, because state law says that, and Democrats aren't in a position to change the state law, right? Because Republicans control all the levers of government. State law says that we have to have a caucus the Monday night, the week before the first primary, right? So even if the DNC says Iowa can't go first anymore, and if you violate our calendar, you're going to not have any delegates that will be seated at the Democratic National Convention, I think that Iowa Democrats may have no choice but to hold some kind of caucus on a Monday night, the same night that the Republican Party holds theirs. But it just might not be meaningful. There might not be any candidates here campaigning.
Right. I was going to say, if you hold a caucus and no candidates come, is it really a caucus?
Well, and some people think, but maybe there will be some long shot person who's trying to build support for the future who may see no downside to coming here and campaigning. I mean, I would call this the most optimistic view, right, for Iowa Democrats. But the bottom line is that state law does say that we have to hold a caucus. It says that the parties have to have their caucuses on the same night. And so even if the DNC changes the calendar, it's likely that some kind of caucus resembling event will occur anyway.
Okay, well, we've got plenty to look forward to in the new year. There's no question about that. And we have plenty to look forward to later this hour, because we are on a full hour and we're going to be talking about all of the impacts of the election 2 weeks ago. And trust me, they're still being felt all around Iowa, and we will be analyzing them. But first, it's about 15 after the hour, wherever you are, and you are in tune with KHY Radio's Capital Week, your one-stop listening post for everything interesting, important, or entertaining about Iowa politics. I'm Dennis Hart with Laura Bellin. Before we go much farther, we want to bring in my old buddy, Tom Beal, and station manager, Mike Murphy. Both of them are my buddies. I've just known Tom a long time. They have some key words about how you can help support this radio station. Tom and Mike, you gentlemen have the mic.
Thank you, Dennis, and thank you for mentioning the word old. We're trying to avoid that in our vocabulary. Hey, you two do such a great job of dissecting the politics that take place here in Iowa and across the nation. And it's one of the great programs that we offer on KHOI. I think our listeners realize that this is a different kind of radio station from what used to be and what can still be found in many parts of the country. That is, we offer a wide variety of programs, and we offer points of view that you can't hear anywhere else. We do it without running one commercial after another. I don't know if you're tired of it, but I certainly am. I like commercial information, but boy, I'm so tired of this unending commercial messages that seem to, you know, the programs have to fit around the commercials rather than the other way around. But you don't hear commercials on our station. And why? Because it's a community radio station, and that means it relies on the community to support it. And that means that we have to ask our listeners from time to time to step up with a donation to help pay the operating costs of the station. We operate on a budget here, a really tight budget, and we I think are able to do a lot with very little money. But we do need you, our listeners, to send us some of that money once in a while, and this is a good time of the year to do it. We're coming to the end of the year, and you're probably beginning to sort out your financial tax picture a little bit. And one of the great things about a community radio station like KHOI is that you can take your donation off your income tax and it gives you a little break, so your money goes a little further. And I can tell you that we spend your money very, very frugally and very carefully. We have this fantastic program that you're hearing, one of the best programs I think you could hear anywhere on politics. And our participants are not paid the salaries that they deserve because community radio doesn't operate on that kind of a basis. Most of our on-air people are volunteers and are not paid. We have a small staff here at the station that is paid, but they're not paid anywhere near enough. So let's get to the point. What can you do to support your community radio station? And Michael, what's the easiest way for them to do it?
It would be to visit our website, khoifm.org, and click on that yellow Become a Member donor button, and it's very swift and secure, and the basic membership is $60. There is no minimum. We're grateful for what we get this week of Thanksgiving. We're grateful to our supporters. But that's the easiest way to do it. People could also call 515-292-2878, but you and I are both in here. And
so you're going to get an answering machine, and then we'll call you back. And you could drop by the station. We're at our new location on Douglas Avenue, just up a block from where we were for 10 years at the Pantorium Building. So you're welcome to drop by sometime during the day, and we would be happy to welcome you and to take your money. Well, this program has been so exceptional, and we do want to take time to ask our supporters and our listeners to help us keep the program on the air. But I think it's time that we return, and let's hear some more politics from our two great political analysts.
Those are tough words to get out, Tom, and since you don't want me to say you're an old friend of mine, you're a seasoned friend of mine, huh? I guess Tom's already gotten up the season. They'll be back soon, Tom and Mike. This is Dennis Hart with Laura Bellin. It's 18 after the hour. This is Capital Week. Normally, we're here a half an hour on Mondays, but we're going to be here a full hour because there's so much to talk about from the election 2 weeks ago. And Laura, finally, the Republicans swept everything statewide in the election except the state auditor's race, where GOP candidate Todd Elber, with no money, came out very close, but finally conceded last week that he lost to incumbent Rob Sanders.
Yes, and it was fascinating. The state Republican Party, which did nothing to support Todd Halber, he was not given any resources during the campaign. He was not invited to come along with Governor Reynolds' bus tour in the latter stages of the campaign. And he said in the statement he posted on Facebook that the state GOP wouldn't provide any resources toward a recount. A recount is a pretty massive undertaking for a statewide race, and it was close. It was about 0.3% difference, just under 3,000 vote differential, but truly that's not close enough for a recount to overcome that kind of margin. A statewide recount typically might change a few dozen votes, but I think you would be lucky to change a few hundred votes and certainly not a few thousand votes.
So Rob Sand, a very important person in Democratic politics in Iowa, the only one holding a statewide office, and the pressure is going to be on him to run for something again in a couple of years or 4 years. Boy, he's going to be the guy.
I think so. And I have heard people say that he showed a map to victory, right? He carried 11 counties. I think that was about the same that Fred Hubble carried. Fred Hubble, of course, fell a little bit short in the 2018 governor's race, lost by about 3 points. Rob Sand, I mean, he was somewhat fortunate that the Republican Party didn't invest in his opponent, but he did manage to overcome a huge deficit at the top of the ticket. It's not easy to be elected when your candidate for governor is losing by 19 points and your party's candidate for Senate is losing by 12 points. That's just a big hurdle to overcome. And as we saw, Attorney General Tom Miller and State Treasurer Michael Fitzgerald were not able to overcome that.
And there are other recounts that either are underway or will be. And let's talk about the closest ones here. In House District 20, Council Bluffs, a recount going on there. There is a seven vote difference between the Democrat and the Republican.
Yes. And this was a very low turnout race, really one of the lowest of the House races that I looked at that were contested. And so it's always painful to lose a close race. And I've talked to campaign staffers who have said it's almost better to be blown out, because when you lose a close race, every tiny thing could have made a difference. A seven vote. Now, usually a recount doesn't overturn seven votes, but you can't rule out the possibility that the auditor's office could discover some issue that could overcome that difference. So right now, the Democrat, Josh Turek, is leading, like you said, by seven votes. I wasn't able to find out when they expect to conclude that recount. One of the House District recounts in a seat in Dubuque already concluded over the weekend.
House District 42, a race in Ankeny, Garrett Gobble, the GOP state representative, versus Democrat Heather Madsen. That finished with a 23-vote difference out of about 14,000 votes, and going to be a recount there.
I mean, I can tell you, just from having followed these legislative races since the 2008 cycle, I've never seen a recount overcome a 20-plus vote difference. I mean, it's almost, I understand requesting the recount, I probably would want to do the same thing, but usually a recount in an Iowa House race will just change a handful of votes. This one in Dubuque, there was one vote difference. In fact, the Democrat was ahead by one vote more after the recount. So I don't think there's any realistic chance. I mean, the Polk County Auditor's Office runs a fairly tight ship, and something extraordinary would have to happen, like discovering a box of ballots that was never counted for some reason, to overcome a 23-vote margin.
And we should say the Democrat, Heather Madsen, is currently leading that by 23 votes. But here's one. House District 81 in Davenport, the recount shows a new winner. How about that?
So there were some big problems in Scott County, and I don't know exactly what went wrong, but the Secretary of State Paul Pate ordered a countywide administrative recount. This is different from something a candidate requests in one district, because there were 400 some absentee ballots that didn't seem to have been counted shortly after the election. The total number of absentee ballots reported wasn't anywhere close to what they should have had. So they did a countywide administrative recount, which lasted for more than 2 days. And once they built in all of these absentee ballots that hadn't been counted, of course, the absentee vote tends to favor Democrats in Iowa. And that meant that instead of in this Iowa House district, which is an open seat, instead of the Republican candidate, Luana Stoltenberg, being ahead by 20-some votes, the Democrat, Craig Cooper, ended up being ahead by 6 votes.
Right. And we should say that there have been several recounts here by hand, by machine. Scott County Board of Supervisors were recanvassing this afternoon, this Monday afternoon, and the candidates can ask for another recount on this.
Yes. And Luana Stoltenberg, she did confirm to me on Friday that she does plan to request a recount. I mean, I think anybody, if you were only trailing by 6 votes, anybody would request a recount, certainly. And it's possible, like I said, there were so many things that seem to have gone wrong in the counting of the votes in Scott County that I would never want to say that 6-vote lead is unassailable. But certainly you would also rather be ahead by 6 votes than behind by 6 votes, because, like I said, I've seen a lot of these recounts in Iowa legislative races, and typically 0 or 1 or 2 or 3 votes will change, not 10 or 15 or 20.
So let's talk about exactly how recounts are conducted in Iowa. It's a complex process. I'll just say it's conducted county by county and cost covered by individual counties. Take it from there.
Well, I think that this was one reason that the Iowa GOP didn't want to get involved in a statewide recount in the state auditor's race. I mean, it's really difficult to do. And one reason is that each county has a recount board of three people. So each candidate involved in the race picks somebody, and then those two designees agree on a third person. Often it's a neutral person. Sometimes it's a judge, for instance. It's usually somebody who's not involved in partisan politics. And then these county recount boards, even if it's a huge county with 100,000 voters, those three people on the recount boards are the only people who can go through and do either the machine count or the hand count, and they're on a very tight schedule. So for a small county with maybe 5 or 10,000 total votes, maybe three people could get through that in several days' work. But it's very difficult. I mean, after the 2020 recount in the second congressional district, a lot of people were calling for the state legislature to change this recount law, but that was one area in election law that hasn't been changed. So I don't know whether the legislature is going to revisit that. I've asked the newly designated chairs of the state government committees in the House and Senate whether they're going to look at this. Haven't heard back from either of them. But these recount boards have to finish their work by no later than 18 days after each county's canvass. And then the final state canvass has to happen in early December, this year, December 5th. So they really don't have a lot of time, especially when you consider that Thanksgiving weekend falls during this period when they would be doing the recount.
So you can see how complex this is. And that's why you don't see a lot of them. But we are seeing them. And you and I will have more to report, if not next week, the week after, on exactly how this all comes out.
Yes. And I mean, in an Iowa House district, it is at least realistic for three people on a recount board to get through all of the votes. I think it would have been very difficult in something like Polk County, where you have almost 200,000 votes, to have a three-person recount board. And they can't pick a lot of other people to help them with this. Under the state law, each county's recount board of just three people has to go through everything. So a statewide recount of the auditor's race would have been kind of a nightmare.
Okay, here's a strange one. It's not a request for a recount. It's a request to consider a challenge to the state Senate leader's registration. Briefly, Iowa Senate Majority Leader Jack Whitmer facing a challenge to his registration from a resident who says he does not live at the address where he is registered to vote. Let's get into that.
So there is a recent precedent for something like this happening in Iowa. State law says, if you're running for the legislature, you have to live in the district where you're on the ballot for at least 60 days before the election. So sometime in September, Jack Whitmer, the top Iowa Senate Republican, would have had to be living in this new district. He moved from, he said it, in any case, he registered at a new address, not the address where his family lives in Ankeny that he's represented for the last decade, but an apartment in Grimes, which is part of a district where there was no incumbent and was also a much more Republican-leaning district. So a voter in Grimes has said he doesn't really live here. And we discussed this a few weeks ago. KCRG reported they got some water records that showed that this apartment in Grimes, where Jack Whitmer has listed as his address, hasn't used any water since January or February. So clearly it's not really being occupied. And there are other, that the voter who challenged the registration said that people had gone to Whitmer's home in Ankeny. They saw packages and mail addressed to there. They knocked on the door, found Whitmer's wife there, who says that the family is still living there. So the sum of it is that they're going to argue that he doesn't really live there. Now, I don't think that this is going to be successful, this challenge, because the way state law is written, it gives a lot of leeway to candidates to say what their residence is.
Okay, we will see how that comes out. Plenty more to talk about. We're going to take a short break one more time here, at least close to half after the hour, and remind you, you're listening to KHOI Radio's Capital Week, where Laura and I are analyzing the effects of the election 2 weeks ago. Plenty more to go. We're on until nearly 8 o'clock tonight. But we're going to take a brief break now to make way for my seasoned buddy, Tom Beal, doesn't like the term old, along with station manager Mike Murphy. And they both have some words about how you can help support this radio station. Gentlemen, you're on.
You make me sound like a hamburger patty when you call me seasoned, but I will say it's better than old. Hey, this has been so fascinating for me to have you dissect and analyze every little nuance of this last election, which was baffling for, I think, a lot of people in Iowa, because the state has been such a swing state for so long, and then suddenly to go in one direction so dramatically. Well, your program is one of the locally produced shows that we are so proud of here at KHOI. We have a lot of locally produced shows, and many of them are music shows, cultural shows of one kind or another. We also get programming from the Pacifica Network. So for our station here in Central Iowa, our community radio station, we offer a heck of a variety of programs. And we do that thanks to you, our listeners, because we rely entirely on you to cover our operating expenses. And so every once in a while, we have to break into our programs and do something that we complain about when the commercial stations do it, and that is we have to interrupt our programming for a special message. And in this case, the message is, why don't you become a member of KHOI? And you can become a member for practically nothing. It's very affordable if you spread it out, or even if you pay it in one lump. And so we invite you to consider becoming a member. Our basic membership fee, Michael, is what?
That's $60 a year or $5 a month.
And that's so small anymore because I know I remember when 60 bucks was a lot of money.
Yeah.
But it isn't very much anymore. And agreed, that's the way to get started. But maybe you feel more generous and you'd like to do more. Well, we would definitely appreciate a larger sum if you're able. We have a $100 membership level. We have a $250 a year membership level. And the sky is the limit, as Michael said, I think, previously. You can give any amount, and it's tax deductible because we are a tax deductible organization. And so there are various ways to make your contribution. Michael, you were mentioning before, one easy way is just to go online.
Yeah, that's pretty easy. KHOIFM.org. Click on the yellow Become a Member Donor button on the left-hand side, and it takes you to a screen that you can fill all that stuff out quite easily. Another way to remember it is KHOIFM.org/membership. That'll take you right there as well. It's really quite simple. And the fact of the matter is, this is the only way community radio happens, is with community support.
Right, and we are so thankful. You know, we're celebrating our 10th year on the air. What an achievement when you think about starting from scratch and somehow cobbling this whole thing together and getting it done with donations. We get no money from the federal government, as some public radio stations do. So once again, the emphasis on our listeners is so great, and we appreciate your support. So KHOIFM.org is probably the easiest way to go, or give us a call at 515-292-2878, and we may not answer the phone right away, but we will get back to you. And Dennis and Laura, your show is so fascinating. I just am so happy that you're able to put it together for us. And it's available online, too. So if you can't listen when the show is being aired, you can hear it on our archives. Well, is it time to go back and do a little more programs? Well, let's hear some more about politics.
All right. I'm Dennis Hart with Laura, and we are here every Monday at this hour. Normally from 7 to 7:30, but we're going a little bit longer tonight to talk about what happened in the election 2 weeks ago and the ramifications that are still being felt. So, Laura, let's talk about how this has affected the state houses, the state house and the state senate. We know that the Republicans are going to have at least a 63-37 edge in the House coming up here. Depends on how some things go on here. But that did not stop the minority Democrats from reelecting their people as leaders last week.
Yes, and I didn't hear about anybody challenging Jennifer Confort for the leadership. I mean, it's a difficult position to be in when you're down that far. And so Lindsey James of Dubuque was reelected as the House Minority Whip. That's the second ranking position for House Democrats. And I think it's just, it's a tough road. Remember, we were just talking about those three races where there are going to be recounts. So the Democrats are leading by 23 votes, 6 votes, and 7 votes. So that's a difference of 40 votes going the other way. They would have had only 34 seats instead of potentially 37 seats. So they're pretty far down. And like I said, I don't think that there was a lot of competition. This is going to be a long rebuild probably for the House Democrats.
And it's going to be a rebuild for the Senate Democrats, too. The GOP will have a 34-16 edge this coming year. And that means that the Democrats cannot block Governor Reynolds' appointments as they used to be able to do. The GOP needed those extra two votes. They got them in this election.
That's right. And so the GOP, they will still need all 34 members to be present, which often isn't the case. But they should be able to schedule most of the confirmation votes on days when they know all members of their caucus will be there. So, and I should say that typically most of the governor's appointees get confirmed anyway. Hundreds a year get confirmed. It's usually only one or two or three that the minority party is able to block. But in the Senate, Democrats are down to 16. That is the smallest minority caucus for quite a while. I think it's been a few decades since either party had that large of a majority. Zach Walls, to my knowledge, was not challenged to be the Senate Democratic leader, but there will be a new Senate Minority Whip because Amanda Reagan, who served for 20 years representing a district, including Mason City, is retiring. And so State Senator Sarah Trongariad, who was just reelected in that marquee race in Dallas County, is going to have a higher profile role now as the second ranking Senate Democrat. And I suspect that that was deliberate because she's going to have to be up for reelection again in 2 years. And that will be a district Republicans will target. So I think that giving her more visibility is probably going to help her.
We've been doing this broadcast for a couple of years now, and we've talked about this, but for those who are just new to us, briefly, what in the world do you believe has happened to Democrats in Iowa? It was a Republican near sweep. It's a red state now. What has happened to Democrats in Iowa?
I think the biggest thing is demographic. I think if you look across the country, a group where Republicans have made the biggest gains over the last 10 years or so is white voters without a college degree. And that's not just true in Iowa. That is literally true almost everywhere in the country. But the difference is that in Iowa, the vast majority of the electorate is comprised of white voters without a college degree. So if you look at a state like Minnesota or Wisconsin, there are a lot of working class towns that for many years elected Democrats and are now electing Republicans. But it doesn't affect the statewide politics to the same degree because, for instance, in Minnesota, they have the Twin Cities Metro where 60%+ of the state's population lives. And in Wisconsin, they also have very large metro in Milwaukee, Madison, a significant college town. They have a more diverse population than Iowa. So it compensates more, whereas in Iowa, we have, especially when you start looking at the legislative districts around the state, there are areas in Northeast Iowa and Southeast Iowa that for many years elected Democratic candidates, but now have become solidly Republican in a really short period of time. Democrats still had a majority in the Iowa Senate, even going into the 2016 general election. And now they're down from leading 26 to 24. Now they're down 34 to 16. So, but I believe that it's a demographic issue. Now, people have a lot of different theories about why white voters without a college degree have drifted so far away from the Democrats. I think that the talk radio space of being very supportive of conservatives, I think that is a factor. The fact that Fox News tends to dominate the information space in smaller communities is a factor. But I mean, some people can argue about that. But I think that that is the biggest challenge for Iowa Democrats. And that's why we see so many towns now, like we were talking last week, places like Fort Dodge, Ottumwa, Clinton, Newton, Keokuk, Burlington, places that for my entire life literally elected Democrats to the Iowa legislature until very recently.
Let's talk about Governor Reynolds. She's being widely credited with leading the Republican near sweep in Iowa. She won a tremendous reelection victory, 19 points. So let's talk about the implications of this. She's going to have larger majorities in the state House and Senate. She has said, we are not done on tax cuts. I think she probably means that, don't you?
Oh, definitely. And the House and Senate Republican leaders have said the same thing. There are still fairly large surpluses. Almost every state now is running a pretty big budget surplus due to the influx of cash from the federal government during the American Rescue Plan and prior to that, the CARES Act. And that money is going to continue to flow for at least two or three more years. So Iowa is going to have a surplus. The state revenue estimating conference is going to meet again in December. but they may lower their revenue estimates a little bit, but I think they'll still be projecting a surplus. And typically what we've seen in Iowa is that whenever there's a budget surplus, Republicans cut taxes.
Of course, we know that the legislature passed the flat tax bill this past session that's going to reduce individual income taxes to 3.9% by 2026. It's very difficult if you're a Democrat to run against tax cuts.
It is. I mean, and it's not clear whether there are going to be completely different tax cuts, more corporate tax cuts, for instance, that the Republicans might consider, or maybe they might just accelerate the phasing in of that flat tax. The way the bill was structured that the governor signed early this year, the higher tax brackets get lowered first, and the people who are lower on the income scale weren't scheduled to see any benefit until 2025 or 2026. So they may change that to bring it down to a flat tax rate more quickly so that people, more middle-income Iowans, will start to see a tax cut sooner.
And let's take this one to the bank. She is going to make another run at school choice, trying to convince the House GOP to back her bill, diverting up to $55 million in taxpayer dollars to help some families transition their kids from public to private or homeschooling. She's going to put that on a fast track.
Well, that is going to be the most interesting thing to watch during the coming legislative session, because that is a priority. She's mentioned now in more than one of her condition of the state speeches. She mentioned it during the campaign. She talked about it in her victory speech on November 8th. And so she is not going to want to fall short on this for a third straight year with a large trifecta. So I don't think it's a done deal yet, though. I think we're going to get to that in a minute.
But here's an interesting thing, and here's the sidebar. Last week, the State House announced creation of a new Education Reform Committee for next year's session, meant to take up any legislation that contains significant reforms to the educational system. Well, that presumably includes the governor's plan. How does this play out?
Okay, so Dennis, I've been following the legislature closely for about 15 years, but for this, I talked to some people who have been watching the legislature a lot longer than that. And nobody can remember anything like this, where the House Speaker is creating a new committee, just a five-member committee, three Republicans and two Democrats, who are going to consider the most important bills. Now, typically, I mean, the House already has an education committee. That committee is going to have a new chair in the coming year because the current education committee chair was defeated in the GOP primary. So, you know, you wonder, why doesn't Pat Grassley want to run this school choice bill and maybe whatever other major education reform bills? Why not run that through the regular committee? And I think that he is taking command of this issue so that the governor's office needs to negotiate with him, and possibly also to give cover to some of his members so they don't need to vote against this voucher plan in committee. It's a very strange thing. Like I said, usually if there's a problem getting a bill through the committee, the speaker would just remove the troublesome people from that committee or just assign the bill to a different committee. But this idea of creating a brand new panel to consider the most important high-profile bills, that's just new.
Yeah, and it's something we're going to be following because it's almost Machiavellian in many ways, and it's just going to be fascinating to see for us how it plays out.
But you might think, well, but the governor, you know, she endorsed these challengers to people who opposed her voucher plan, and most of them were successful, and so won't these House Republicans be afraid to stand up to her on vouchers? It's not clear. I mean, it's very possible that some of them will fold under the pressure, but there's a lot of really firm opposition to this bill. Many of the rural superintendents say that it's going to be bad for their districts. Nobody wants a school to close in their legislative district. And so there may still, even with this large majority the House Republicans have, it is possible that they aren't going to be able to find the 51 votes they need. We know that none of the House Democrats will ever vote for anything like the governor's voucher plan.
Right. And briefly, let's talk about abortion. This is a long-term issue. The governor's asked the state court to reinstate the 2018 fetal heartbeat law, which, as most people know, would ban abortions after about 6 weeks of pregnancy, with some exceptions. Something's going to happen on abortion this coming year.
Well, I think so. I mean, the governor and the Republican legislative leaders keep saying that they're going to focus on this effort to reinstate the 2018 law. We probably in late December or sometime in January, the Polk County District Court is going to rule on that motion. And then whatever the losing side, whether it's the state or Planned Parenthood is going to appeal to the Iowa Supreme Court. But this is going to take months to play out. And meanwhile, the legislature will be in session. And I just find it hard to believe that there won't be pressure from the anti-abortion interest groups on Republicans to pass a new bill and start trying to implement that. I just think that for the legislature to come and go and do nothing new on abortion when the Iowa Supreme Court probably isn't going to rule on this until sometime next summer or fall, it just doesn't seem very likely to me. But for now, you can't get any Republican legislator on the record talking about what they might pass with abortion next year.
It's about 15 before the hour. This is Capital Week on KHY Community Radio. Laura and I here every week to talk politics Iowa style. And we still have a few more minutes to go. But first, I want to bring in, I can't say my old friend. I can't say my seasoned friend. My longtime friend.
Hey, you got it. You're a wordsmith if there ever was one. Dennis and I taught journalism together many years ago at Greenlee School at ISU. And so we indeed are old friends, and I'll use that word lovingly in this case. Well, you two do such a magnificent job, of trying to figure out, explain what the heck is happening in the political scene here in Iowa. And I, for one, appreciate your doing that because, frankly, I follow politics quite a bit and I'm confused. And so having you two kind of lay this out and here's where we're likely to go and here's why is really helpful. Well, I hope our listeners agree with me. I think they do because you're one of our most successful programs, and we do have a large audience that clings to your every word. And if they do that, we hope they realize that we need them to support the station so we can continue to bring your program and all the other programs that we have to them, and they can listen. They could listen without paying anything. It could be free. But, of course, there is a cost involved in producing these programs and operating the station, and that's why we turn to our listeners. We turn to you, our listeners, and we say, hey, would you like to have this continue? And if you do, then we ask you to become a member and a supporter of KHOI. And you can do that so simply. And Michael, you've said on more than one occasion, it's really easy. If you've got a computer, you just go to your computer. And what happens?
Yeah, you can even do it from your phone. Go to khoyfm.org, and there's a kind of mustard, we're saying yellow, but mustard-colored Become a Member Donor button. You click on that, it takes you to a page that you just fill out the information, and voila, you're done.
Voila. Hey, and you know, some people like to set it up on a monthly basis.
Yes.
So that they don't even feel the amount of money going out because it's just part of their regular budget. And the money comes to us every month in that case, and boy, it helps us in our financial planning. We hold the cost down, boy, just to the bare minimum, but it still takes few thousand dollars actually a month to operate our station. And so we ask you to help us pay those bills. And this is the time to do it. So as Michael said, khoyfm.org, and you indeed can do that from your smartphone. If you're smart enough to know how to operate the smartphone, I will admit that I'm somewhat intimidated by mine. They could call us too, Michael.
515-292-2878. I want to write a jingle with that number in it.
Like the old days of radio. Yeah, well, Eric, one of our great programmers, has a wonderful show, and he uses all these old radio commercials that include the singing call letters. Mm-hmm. Anyway, there's still some more important stuff to talk about politics, and so let's return to our political show, and thank you, too, for doing such a great job.
And Mike and Tom, thank you, too, for being on the show tonight. You are two fine gentlemen who I am privileged to know and look forward to working with you a long time into the future, I hope, which must mean we have to turn back the clock on some of this time stuff. Laura, let's move down formatically here. We've got about 7 minutes left and talk about, we don't even have to talk about it, mention it. The GOP is going to get control. They did get control of the U.S. House. The Democrats are going to control the Senate. It's going to be a free-for-all next year. We know that, and we'll be talking about it. But last week in the Senate, Senator Grassley voted against the same-sex marriage bill. Senator Ernst voted in favor of it. Let's download some of that.
So this was interesting. This vote was postponed until after the election. This is a bill that the House passed months ago. And there was speculation that the Senate, that there were at least 10 Senate Republicans willing to support it to help overcome a filibuster. You need 60 votes in the Senate to get past a procedural hurdle. But Joni Ernst had not said ahead of time. She said she had an open mind and she was evaluating the bill. So when she came out last week and was one of the 12 Republicans who helped break the filibuster, that was quite interesting. Now, Chuck Grassley had also said that he wasn't sure how he was going to vote on the bill. He ended up voting. This wasn't a vote on final passage. This is a vote to begin debate on it, technically. But he voted. He was one of the 37 Republicans who would have blocked that legislation. I thought it was interesting since Grassley is very unlikely ever to appear on a ballot again. But Joni Ernst presumably is going to be up for reelection in 2026. That she did not want to be on record trying to block legal protections for same-sex couples.
So the Senator Grassley, he said he supports same-sex and interracial marriages, but that the bill was not needed because no effort exists to overturn the Supreme Court decision that legalized it.
Yeah, this was news to me. I'm going to read now directly. This is just a portion of the statement his office released. Of course, I believe that all married couples should be able to continue to benefit from the same federal rights and privileges that Barbara and I have enjoyed for 68 years, regardless of their race or sexual orientation. And I thought, wow, I don't remember Senator Grassley saying that before. And in fact, when I went back and looked to see what he said when the U.S. Supreme Court issued that decision in 2015 that struck down all of the state same-sex marriage bans, in fact, he said he was very critical of the Supreme Court majority and said that they had undermined the ability of the citizens to define marriage through the democratic process. So this was kind of news, and he made it sound very matter-of-fact. Well, of course, I think that all couples should have the same rights. So that was interesting. He didn't want to say that he was opposing the bill because he doesn't support same-sex marriage rights.
Very interesting. All right, we have 4 minutes left. The state Supreme Court in Iowa heard a wrongful firing case against Governor Reynolds. This one we've talked about many times in the past year. Lawyers for the governor said that the court should reverse a lower court's refusal to dismiss an alleged whistleblower's wrongful termination lawsuit. It involved Polly Carver Kim. Let's take it from there.
So Polly Carver Kim was the communications staffer for the Iowa Department of Public Health for about 12 years. And very early on in the COVID-19 pandemic, she was sidelined, duties were taken away from her, and then about 4 months into the pandemic, she was fired. And she filed this lawsuit claiming that she was removed because she had released public information both about the pandemic and released public records also about abortion statistics in Iowa. She was suing the department and the governor's communications director at the time. So the Supreme Court is not right now considering whether she was wrongly fired or the merits of her case. This is a procedural step where the state is trying to throw out the case and say that she shouldn't even be able to bring this lawsuit, and she shouldn't be able to say that the governor removed her because the governor didn't have authority to remove her. And so this was all just over procedural arguments. The lower court already rejected the state's efforts to dismiss the case. So the Supreme Court is either going to say, nope, the case should be tossed, or no, it should be sent back to the lower court and go to trial. And then the trial would consider the merits of her claim. So there were a lot of complicated legal arguments, but that's the gist. The Iowa Supreme Court is not going to decide whether Governor Reynolds did or did not wrongly fire Polly Carver Kim. They're just going to decide at this stage whether this is a lawsuit that can even be brought.
And last week, there was more bad news for the Biden Student Loan Forgiveness Program, which affects a lot of students in Iowa and every other state.
Yes. So there have been a few different lawsuits filed. And right now, the entire student loan debt relief is on hold because the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals overturned a lower court ruling that had dismissed one of these lawsuits. This is the one that Governor Reynolds joined on behalf of Iowa, and six states are part of that. So it's eventually the U.S. Supreme Court is going to have to decide. I think the key legal issue here is going to be whether any of these plaintiffs even have standing to challenge the program, because they have to be able to demonstrate that they were injured in some way. Not you can't just file a lawsuit against a federal policy because you don't agree with the policy or you think it's wrongheaded. You have to be able to show that you suffered some kind of, usually a financial injury or some other kind of an injury. So that's what's going to be interesting as that litigation moves forward. But for now, the people are not going to be getting the student loan relief that they might have been expecting.
And in the last minute, newly reelected Iowa Congresswoman Marionette Miller-Meeks was at a climate summit in Egypt.
Yes, this is the UN, this is the formerly known as COP27, a massive global climate change conference. I think it's interesting because Marionette Miller-Meeks is the only Republican from Iowa who has made this one of her signature issues she wants to work on. She joined the House, what's called the Conservative Climate Caucus. There are about 75 members of that caucus, but she was part of a group of only six who traveled to Egypt for this. She was talking up agricultural technology as ways for precision agriculture to reduce emissions, and also talking about how she would like to see the Congress invest more in nuclear power as a way to reduce carbon emissions. I expect probably a lot of gridlock the next 2 years, but since Republicans will be in control of the House, it'll be fascinating to see what happens, what kind of work goes on with climate change. But it's to me, you don't hear a lot of Iowa Republicans talking about climate change. So for Marionette Miller-Meeks to make this one of her priority issues and want to be out there publicly discussing it is unusual.
Laura, we're out of time. Briefly, what are you and your family doing for Thanksgiving?
Oh, we're staying here. We're staying in and having a quiet weekend, and I'm looking forward to that.
As my wife and I are. Hey, you have a great Thanksgiving with your family, your children, and your dog, Sammy.
Absolutely. And I am very grateful to KHOI for this platform. I really appreciate it. And I hope that people do kick in and support the station because there is such diverse programming, talk as well as music. And so I really hope people will go to khoifm.org and check that out.
Indeed. This has been Capital Week, a reminder that the views and opinions expressed here did not necessarily reflect the opinions of KHOI or its staff. Laura and I will be back next week in the same time slot, and we'll talk about everything interesting, important, or entertaining about politics Iowa style. We hope you can join us. Between now and then, thank you so much for the privilege of your time. Happy Thanksgiving, and have a safe, healthy, and happy week.